into week six of COVID-19 induced business restrictions. The pandemic is raising some important questions among the Grey Shoes Brigade as we see increased filing for business rescue. Measuring and accurately reporting on a firm's going concern status and just doing the routine work of audit is becoming increasingly fraught. Uncertainty and unpredictability are obviously creating risks of material misstatements that are new or intensified in the circumstances. And when planning the audit, auditors may not have considered some of these risks or may have considered identified risks differently. Our businesses being audited are also struggling to forecast next week, let alone next month or year, which makes disclosure in financial statements and their ability to maintain operations in the foreseeable future challenging, to say the least. Let's welcome our panel today. Freeman Nomvalo, the CEO of SAICA, the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, and Bernard Agulhas, the Chief Executive Officer of the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors, IRBA. Freeman, kick us off. I'm sure Eskom seems like another lifetime away, but just set the scene for us here. Broadly, how has COVID-19 impacted the auditing and accounting profession?
Thanks, Michael. The COVID-19 has changed lives in a very fundamental way for everyone, and especially for auditors. Auditors have to provide an assurance to investors on the financial information of various clients that they have. And in order to do that, they need to examine information presented by the clients to them, and they need to provide, to obtain evidence that enables them to reach a conclusion on whether those financial statements are free from material misstatements, they are accurate, and so in order for them to obtain that evidence, they have to gain access to the premises of the clients. And with the lockdown, that has changed, because if the auditor did not have that information prior to lockdown, it may be difficult for the auditors to obtain that. And that will impact the conclusions that they reach or the work that they need to do before they reach such conclusions.
So quite clearly, the operational issues are one of access at a time when we are still severely limited. How has that changed going from complete lockdown now into level four? Because I know there was also an issue around the essential service declaration of accountants and not being declared essential services. That has now changed under level four. Take me through how this is evolving.
Well, it would have helped if accountants' work and auditors' work was declared an essential service. It has not been. So essentially, you're still in the same position that you were in, unless, of course, your client is a client that is providing essential services, in which case then there is an opportunity for auditors to apply. It's not automatic even in that instance, but they may then at least approach the authorities in order to obtain permission so that they can then gain access to the information they need to execute their functions.
Bernard, I want to bring you in here as the regulator. Obviously, there are specific laws and regulations that are governing this entire process. Can you just set the scene for us from a regulatory perspective and just give some colour as to how auditors and accountants are operating in an environment where, as Freeman has already stated, they haven't been declared an essential service, and many company year ends are coming up, and there's a deadline extension, I'm aware, that has been granted, but it makes things very difficult.
Thank you, Michael. The first thing that we've done from a regulatory perspective is, and I think a lot of the solutions that we are trying to find has been possible because we formed a task force between regulators, the auditors, the Institute, SAICA, and some other structures as well, so that we could firstly discuss and table the concerns from auditors, the challenges that they face, and together come up with specific solutions to those issues. So I think that has been very helpful. It's chaired by the RBA, and it's been very useful in the sense that we meet once a week, and once the auditors table the actual physical challenges that they face in getting to complete their audits, and what they need from regulators, at least we can come up with solutions. And the extension of deadlines have been very has been a direct result of these discussions. The regulators involved are the RBA, the JSE, SIPC, and the Reserve Bank. And then we meet with the audit leaders of the five big firms to identify exactly what challenges they face. What also came out of one of these meetings was the issue that was just mentioned around essential services. And unfortunately, you can only perform an audit if you audit the company which provides essential services. And about a week ago, we wrote to the Minister of COCTA to ask that they not declare all audits as essential services, but at least to allow the auditors of public interest entities where public monies are involved and where the public is at risk, that those can be audited, because it doesn't help to say that a company which does not provide essential services cannot have financial reporting, cannot have audited results, because it will impact on the market after the lockdown period. And therefore, we have written to the Minister of COCTA. We've also asked for the support from our own minister, and we have received a response to say that they are looking into how they can support auditors of public interest entities.
That is encouraging to hear that they are looking at that. Freeman, from your perspective, what is the impact of COVID-19 on the auditors' considerations of laws and regulations at this time?
Of course, the auditors have to report on compliance or non-compliance on laws and regulations. So they have to make sure that they obtain information that enables them to reach that conclusion. And of course, one of the problems, as Bernard has just indicated, is that with the audit not being an essential service, we've got to approach the authorities in relation to that. But again, there are a number of reporting requirements that various entities, public interest entities and other entities, in terms of different legislations, that they have to comply with. In other words, submit returns by a particular point in time. And all of those, some of those returns require that the auditors look at them and provide some assurance. And it's difficult to be able to do those. For instance, SARS requires returns on VAT, requires returns on the performance of companies. And you need SARS to collect the revenue in order for a number of the packages that government is also announcing to support small enterprises, to support society during this time. And therefore, there is a need for auditors to assist in that regard. So this has complicated the landscape, to say the least, quite a bit, because then entities will not be able to comply for what they need to do for SARS, and auditors need to help them to do so. And then do auditors then report in that instance, or do auditors find alternative ways in which that matter gets resolved, which might even delay the time in which the report of the auditor gets issued.
Mm-hmm. So it just demonstrates the interconnectedness of the entire sort of ecosystem here. Bernard, to come back to your point about writing to the various ministers around declaring auditing an essential service, what is the rationale or the reason behind not allowing auditors to go and do the work that they do? Obviously, there has to be some degree of physical interaction, but surely in an environment now where we've been under lockdown, we are all hopefully practicing our social distancing and hand washing and wearing masks, we can do audits in a way that doesn't present a material risk.
I believe, Michael, that the rationale behind not allowing auditors to do audits really comes from the social distancing. Auditors, when they do go out to a client, obviously there's going to be interaction between them. And because the audit has to be conducted in a way in which, unfortunately, it's very difficult to obtain all the information that you require without that close contact with the client. It has not been, I think, recognized how important it is that audits still continue. So it, on the one hand, we're trying, and I'm sure that the government is trying to ensure that the health issues are addressed by ensuring that there's social distancing. But at the same time, we cannot not carry on with audits because of the possible impact on the economy after the lockdown and when this is all over. In fact, now is the time that we should continue to comply with standards, not only the compliance with laws and regulations, but also to comply with the code of ethics, to comply with the auditing standards, especially now when there is a heightened risk that fraud could take place, that auditors are not that close to their clients to exercise professional skepticism. And therefore, we encourage auditors to continue to comply with the standards, the code of ethics, the requirements to comply with reporting of non-compliance with laws and regulations. We continue with that. But hopefully, when it is recognized that audits are still essential, then it will not override the importance of the health issues, but at least there can be a healthy balance between the need to do the audit balanced with not exposing anybody's health to any risk.
It's a common sense based approach, that, and I want to stay with you a while longer, Bernard, because you said you've written to the COGTA minister. We've got the deadline. Can you just share some detail around how much longer that grants companies or reporting entities in terms of an extension here, and what your timeline, your expected timeline is here, because this is urgent, as you've just demonstrated.
Well, while audits can continue, we must also recognize that auditors might be set up to work remotely, but they cannot. There's a lot that they cannot do. One of the examples that we experienced last week was with the year ends. We were at a year end, and physical stock counts had to take place, and that is actually what drove us to write to the minister in all urgency to say, when we, it's not a matter of, you can't perform a stock count after the event. Yes, there's alternative procedures that you can carry out. But the other alternative, if you cannot carry out those other procedures, is that we will see a spate of qualified audit reports in the market. And that is how we justify to the minister that we need an urgent response, because the last thing we want to see is that financial statements are qualified because auditors couldn't do physical stock counts. And therefore, there will be no reliance on those financial statements. It will affect foreign direct investment, et cetera. And that is hopefully what the minister will consider in responding to us as soon as possible.
Freeman, I want to move on now to this new environment, and I think we have touched on it briefly, but it does raise the risk potentially of increased fraud, of increased corruption. I was chatting to the Auditor General, Kimi Mkhwetu, last week, and he's already setting up a special task force within the AG's office at the moment to ensure that we don't have any leakage in that 500 billion rand that's been announced by government at this time. But what do you see as the impact here on auditors on the ground as they approach determining things like what is material at a time like this, but without having the ability to do that in any meaningful way, only going through digital documents? It makes the life of the auditor very difficult.
Very difficult indeed. Before I answer your question, I must say that I'm glad Erba has written to the minister, because we also have written to the minister for exactly the same reason. And yeah, the risk of misstatement is heightened under the current environment for a number of reasons. An entity that is owed money by outside people, those people may not be able to pay as quickly as possible, but also some may not even be able to pay those amounts owed to the entity. And because they are not able to pay, it then affects the value at which you reflect that debt in the books. So there may be misstatements as well as a result of that, but also fraud and error is a potential risk that auditors face, and therefore they need to be conscious of that and think about how and what procedures they're going to put in place in order that they're going to implement in order to deal with this. Some entities, all of the information that gets presented at the end of any reporting year for an entity is prepared on the assumption that that entity will continue to be able to operate in the foreseeable future, which they will refer to as going concern. And with the clients being unable to pay for what they owe, and with some of the stock that they may be carrying in their books losing its value, because some of them may have expiry dates and all of those things, it then brings the possibility that some of those things may impact the ability of that entity to continue to exist. And how at what value do you value some of the assets that are sitting in these
Freeman's
ways in which they point in executing those audits. Of course, the compliance with the regulations is one of such risks.
So, Bernard, what we're hearing here is there's an awful lot more for an auditor to consider at a time like this. And I can just think of the likes of SAB, for example, carrying a whole lot of stock on its books that they potentially now have to dispose of because it's been sitting there for an extended period. What would your advice be to the auditing profession on the way they approach this issue of materiality at a time like this?
Right at the beginning of the crisis, and we issued guidance to auditors to remind them of the standards that they need to focus on a little bit more, where they need to do more work. We made it very clear, and I think SAICA has done the same, that standards are not to be relaxed during this period. In fact, auditors must be very careful that they continue to comply with the auditing standards. And the areas that we've highlighted, for example, was, as Freeman already mentioned, going concern, and we've given them some guidance and reminded them that it's important to get going concern. Events after the balance sheet date, and when it comes to stock valuation, obviously they have to look at the measurement and disclosure of any, not just stock, but all financial instruments, and management's assumptions and management's valuation of these financial matters become very important. And we've just reminded auditors to focus on those issues and to be very careful to exercise more caution when they have to perform audit procedures that relate to any of those financial statement items, not only stock, but all items that could potentially be misstated, so that they don't end up issuing qualified audit reports.
And when we talk here, Freeman, about management assumptions, many of the CEOs and executives I've spoken to over the last month have spoken to me about the fact that it's very difficult to see 1 week out. It's like navigating through an intense fog. You can't make predictions about how consumers might react or respond once we go through the different levels of lockdown. So it's very difficult for management teams to forecast in an environment like this. How do you then stress test the assumptions that management teams are giving you if even the management teams are finding it very hard to model and forecast any future?
It makes it a lot more difficult indeed, Michael. And the information that management will provide in support of the assumptions that they are making needs to be tested. And the adequacy of that information that is provided by management needs to be evaluated by the auditors, so that auditors can satisfy themselves that, yes, it is uncertain, nobody knows the future, but at least based on the information that has been presented to them, based on the knowledge of the industry and so on, which then brings another dynamic, by the way, for an auditor who may have just won an audit client in the last short while and may still need to get to grips with the industry as well as the business of that particular client. So auditors have got an added responsibility, and I'm encouraged. Bernard made reference to the task force that was established by ERBA. I'm encouraged with the sentiment that we are finding from the auditors in those interactions, that they are extra committed to high quality audits, even in the current environment. They don't take anything for granted. They ask questions where they think there needs to be clarification provided by structures like ERBA and other institutes. They take that very, very seriously. So what is encouraging is that, yes, the environment is fluid, it is complex, it is uncertain, but what we see being the attitude of the auditors and their commitment is really encouraging.
I hope you were taking a dig there at the decision to mandatory or mandate audit firm rotation there around clients having to get used to new firms. But on that point, Bert, maybe it's an important point. Is the idea, because before COVID-19, ERBA had been pushing for mandatory audit firm rotation because there were too many scandals in the South African marketplace where the auditors had become too familiar. There wasn't a sufficient degree of professional skepticism. Does this now put that on the back burner a little bit, considering that it is just all about dealing with the here and now of COVID-19? What impact do you see that having behind that momentum?
Michael, before I respond to the mandatory audit firm rotation question, could I just go back to the task force that we talked about earlier? And you made reference to an ecosystem. And I agree with Freeman that it's been quite useful to see how this ecosystem have come together and everybody's working together to get past this crisis. But included on that task force, we've also included structures like the King Committee, the Audit Committee Forum, and the IOD, and they deal with directors and those charged with governance. And to answer some of your questions that you posed earlier about how does the auditors respond to this crisis, I think it's quite useful that those structures have also issued guidance on what challenges they should be aware of the auditors are facing, so they could also support auditors in responding to those challenges. In respect to your question on mandatory audit firm rotation, fortunately, the effective date is 1 April 2023. And although at this stage we don't know how long this national disaster will continue, there's not much. It won't have any impact. The current disaster won't have any impact on audit firm rotation because it's only effective in a couple of years' time. And also the five-year cooling off period had already kicked in. So auditors that wanted to change had already changed proactively. And there shouldn't be any impact in the next year or two.
On the issue of cost, Freeman, and coming back to you, do you see this period increasing the cost of audit for firms out there?
I wouldn't rule that possibility out necessarily because the auditors are needing more time, are needing to conduct alternative procedures, in some instances, dig a little bit deeper in order to arrive at a considered opinion that is so that they can provide an assurance on those financial statements. And those things come at a cost, but with the technological advancement that we've had, and one point that has to be mentioned when we talk about the COVID-19, I was having a conversation with some small practitioners a few weeks ago, and some of them who had audits that they were anticipating that would be happening during this time, they already had cloud technology and so on, and they were able to upload some of that information and then are able to continue with the audit. Of course, there are certain limitations, as Martin myself have indicated, but some of those technological advancements do help to make sure that we can, at least the cost can be minimized. But substantive procedures that may be necessary come at a cost, of course.
Just lastly, and I'm delving into your past a little bit here because you were South Africa's Accountant General for several years, and chatting to Kimmy Mkhwetu last week, there is obviously a concern given our history and the fact that we've uncovered so much in terms of the tentacles of state capture, that this provides scope for further corruption in the public sector, this period where it's very difficult to conduct and do audits. Where do you see the greatest risk, and are you satisfied that we're doing enough to ensure that public monies are not ferreted away through theft or misspending or corruption?
I think certainly more can be done because as the Auditor General issues his reports, you find a lot of these challenges and a lot of these weaknesses being identified in various institutions that they audit. And these bring the risk, heightened risk of fraud and corruption. So it is. Are we doing enough? I think no, we can do more. We could probably diagnose the problem a lot more deeper, because if we have a good diagnosis and a correct diagnosis of where the problem lies, we should then be able to come up with measures that are going to be able to make an impact in relation to what we find. I do think that sometimes it's easy to think of some of these challenges as emanating from a public sector that is corrupt, but they don't corrupt themselves. They also work in tandem with private sector players who enable them to commit or entice them to commit the fraud. So we do need to think about a solution that deals with this thing comprehensively. very, very few cases have come before the courts, even though that process takes long. Very, very few cases have come before the courts where the corruptor and the corruptee have been charged and prosecuted alongside. And I think it's something that has to happen and happen quickly so that we begin to deal with and create disincentives for fraud to continue.
Absolutely, and to start to see some accountability. Gentlemen, thank you very much. That was Freeman Mbalo, the CEO of SAICA, who is joined by Bernard Gullis, who's the CEO of the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors, IRBA. Certainly the grey shoe is being given grey hairs by COVID-19.